Committee on Ways and Means, Public Safety Subcommittee for Monday, April 4, 2005. We will have a public hearing and work session first on a federal grant application with the Oregon Youth Authority. This is a workplace and community transition training for incarcerated youth offenders grant. And then we will follow that with a public hearing on Senate Bill 5530, Oregon Youth Authority. And let's see, Ms. Baker, would you like to tell us about the grant application? And someone from the agency, please come forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is the grant application that the Oregon Youth Authority is bringing forward. Normally during the interim, the emergency board deals with federal grant applications, but obviously while we're in session, the subcommittees deal with that. If you do a recommendation to approve the grant application today, then the process would be that this grant application recommendation would go forward to the next full committee, whenever that may be, but with the understanding that the agency during this time period would be able to submit the application, of course, subject to pulling it back if the full committee didn't agree. But that's the process during the session for the federal grant applications. And you should have in front of you both our office's analysis of the grant application and then a copy of the agency's letter requesting permission to apply. Those were also delivered to your offices last week in case you had a chance to look at them ahead of time.
And Ms. Baker, I would add to what you said that the co-chairs have also reviewed and approved the submission of this federal grant.
The Madam Chair, the co-chairs have approved the subcommittee considering it.
All right.
They are waiting for the subcommittee's action, but yes, they've approved it in the sense that it's been scheduled for a hearing.
All right. Very good. Mr. Jester?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Jester, Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. And as Ms. Baker pointed out, we are before you today to seek permission to apply to the U.S. Department of Education for a grant to provide services to youth in our correctional facilities transitioning back to their communities. This federal grant is available to states to apply for. The grant approval is expected on July the 1st of 2005. Eligible youth are those who have been adjudicated as adults, are under the age of 26, and within 5 years of release or release eligibility. Oregon Youth Authority currently has no funding for post-secondary education, and those youth who are in our facilities that are involved in post-secondary education are doing so either by donations or some other avenue to pay for those services. The funding availability that we are seeking is to provide services for an estimated 158 youth who would be eligible. It would be at the amount of $1,500 per student per year, with an additional $300 for related services per student per year. And if the federal funding is awarded, the agency will return to legislature to seek approval to accept the grant and limitation to expend grant funds. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Mr. Jester, are these youth who would need to be identified, or are they youth who have already been identified in your system?
Madam Chair, these are youth who are currently in our system and have been identified through our current education service providers.
And in that population of youth, are we speaking of male and female?
Madam Chair, yes, we are.
Other questions by Representative Hanna?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jester, how does the grant dovetail onto the current educational process, like, for instance, where we toured the school?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, that's an excellent question. The Department of Education provides funding through contract at McLaren for the Willamette ESD, and that funding is primarily for those youth working toward their high school completion and vocational training. Once they have completed high school, if they have the interest and the capacity to go on to secondary education, then there is not funding in the ODE contract with that provider to provide these services. So this would be over and above those services provided through Willamette ESD.
Follow up, Madam Chair?
Please continue.
Then how does the ESD fit into higher education model then? How do the ESD dollars that are being requested, the $63,000 for administrative reimbursement ESD, how does that fit into that model?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, it's my understanding that the ESD would coordinate those services within the context of the classrooms and the school building and do the record keeping and those sorts of things. The administrative function that would otherwise be done if a youth were attending a community college or a university would be picked up by the ESD.
One more follow-up, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to understand how it would work. I'm wondering why it doesn't go through the community college system then, just because you don't currently deal with them, or...
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, we do deal with them and have in the past dealt with them when the Department of Education was a recipient of these same grant funds. But in order for the education services to be delivered within a correctional facility like McLaren, there needs to be somebody in the classroom that is coordinating that process with offenders. And in the context of our facilities, that has been the ESD staff.
Thank you.
Further questions or comments? Ms. Gilbert, did you have comments on this one?
Only a recommendation.
Please.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, for the record, Linda Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. The department recommends that the subcommittee approve the agency's request to apply for the subject grant.
Okay. Senator Devlin, I will accept the motion.
So moved, Madam Chairman. I've read the grant application, and I think it's an excellent application.
It has Senator Devlin moves adoption of the Oregon Youth Authority federal grant application, workplace and community transition training for incarcerated youth offenders. Any objection? Adopted. And we'll need a carrier on the House side, one on the Senate side. Senator Devlin?
Madam Chair, I believe you just need one carrier because this will just go to full.
Okay.
If full approves it, it doesn't go to the House and the Senate floor.
Yes. Thank you very much. Okay. We will put a public hearing on Senate Bill 5530, Oregon Youth Authority. We are beginning, colleagues, with an agency overview. And then we will move to a governor's recommended budget overview with Ms. Gilbert. Ms. Gilbert.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, in front of you are the Phase 2 overview materials that I prepared. There's a memorandum, a short two-page memorandum with a chart attached to it. And then there is another copy of our legislative fiscal office analysis in case you misplaced the one that we had handed
it's
out.
It's the same,
earlier.
No changes?
No changes. Good. In the analysis, yes. And I will briefly go through the bullet points that I have outlined on this memo. It's dated April 4th. The agency mission, as you've already heard, is to protect the public by holding youth offenders accountable and providing opportunities for reformation. Primary programs and customers, very shortly there, a continuum of juvenile justice services, which includes juvenile crime prevention, the county diversion grants, community-based residential care treatment, parole probation services, and the juvenile correction facilities. In terms of customers, individual youth offenders and their families, county juvenile departments, other partners in the juvenile justice system, and of course the general public in terms of public safety protection. The major policy and budget issues, I've identified two that are very high level. The second one's closely related to the first. But the first, from my perspective, is that the youth authority has been charged with maintaining a balanced system of services, so a variety of services from community prevention programs through their juvenile correction facilities, the closed custody beds. And not only do they need to maintain that system of services, but it has to serve a diverse population with specialized and, in many cases, multiple needs. And the challenge, I think, that we've seen is that particularly in a time of budget constraints, how do you maintain a balanced system of services where when the system is being reduced overall, it becomes in some cases very difficult to maintain certain programmatic aspects that you need to have just because of losing some economies of scale. And then the second bullet I've identified there is the close custody piece of the youth authority's mission, and that's managing the youth offenders within the 850 budgeted beds, which is well short of the forecast demand. And we'll hear more from Sue Porter later today about the close custody forecast. But the issue here is that maintaining those 850 budgeted beds is a challenge at the state level programmatically. It's also a challenge in terms of relationships with the counties and who's in and who's out in those discretionary beds. So that becomes a big issue for this budget. And I've attached a chart just for your information that shows the close custody population from 1994 through the end of 2004. So you can see in 1994, before Oregon Youth Authority was established as a separate entity and before Measure 11 passed, providing determinate sentences for some of the offenders that were charged to OYA, you can see there was a much lower close custody bed capacity in 94, but beginning in 95, that started ramping up. And the peak, if you will, was in the 99-2001 biennium. You can see there were almost 1,200 beds at some points in time. But then in early 2003, when Measure 28 was defeated, OYA as a budget savings mechanism began to close four of the regional youth correctional facilities, and so you can see the downturn there in terms of capacity. It's come back up a little bit because the 2003 legislature phased in an additional 50 beds over this last biennium, but that 850 beds is where the governor's budget maintains the capacity for the 2005-2007 biennium. So this was just to give you a little bit of history in terms of where the agency has been. Going back to the bottom of page one of my memo then, there was one budget note for the agency. It dealt with gang intervention funding for Multnomah County, and a report was required on how that money was used and what the outcomes of that were. And that report was made, and I can provide you with a copy of that if you're interested. On top of the second page, I've identified the agency-specific emergency board actions that were approved during this past biennium. There was a federal funds expenditure limitation added for a sex offender management grant. In April 2004, partially to address or to partially address some budget reductions that were required after the defeat of Measure 30, the Emergency Board allocated $1 million general fund so that the reopening of the North Coast Warrenton facility would proceed, although a little bit later than originally anticipated, but those beds were funded. And then in January of 2005, as part of an overall $2 million allocation for gang enforcement, for youth gang enforcement and intervention funding, OYA received $1.25 million general fund. Then the next two bullets address Secretary of State's audits. There was a change of director review when the former director left in December of 2004. And then there were some specifically audited accounts and transactions that were audited as well. No reportable conditions, but there were some recommendations for improvements that the Secretary of State included in its management letter to the agency. Revenue sources, just high-level summary, it's mostly general fund. There's some other funds and a little bit of federal funds, mostly Medicaid. Reimbursements for the community program services and some for administrative costs related to those services. And then to put the governor's budget in a nutshell, and we'll get some more detail on this from both budget and management and the agency, but just the four bullets I wanted to highlight. Again, there's 850 close custody beds for youth offenders. The full forecast of expected demand is not funded. Most of the other pieces of the budget, the community parole and probation, foster care treatment services, county diversion, and OIA's piece of the juvenile crime prevention grants are funded at their ongoing level, so their current level plus a little bit of inflation. The governor's budget does reduce funding for the Multnomah County gang intervention money, reducing it from $2.5 million to $1.9 million. And then there are some other small packages that you will see and other small adjustments in the budget for position reclassifications, relocation of a county parole and probation office, and then the governor's Oregon Smart Buy savings.
Questions or comments for Ms. Baker? Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sheila, the audit by the Secretary of State when the director changed, I think that's probably a good idea. Is that normal? That was a request by the new?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisner, the Secretary of State always does a review when an agency director leaves. So they look at, you know, did the keys get turned in? You know, did the security for the computer system get changed? All that kind of thing.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I had another question. I did not read the report that was submitted to the board about the gang intervention. Are we going to continue to focus that in the Multnomah County? Was a recommendation. There's not enough money to look at other parts of the state for that grant.
Madam Chair and Representative Wisnett, this report that was made to the Emergency Board in 2004 focused on just how the money in Multnomah County was used. The governor's budget continues the funding for the Multnomah County piece at a reduced level, as I've indicated. The action that the Emergency Board took in January did expand those funds, or basically allocated additional funds that were used over a broader area. And the agency can talk about how they allocated that funding. But the intention of that money, at the time it was indicated that those were one-time funds. And so those don't show up in the governor's budget.
Please continue.
One other question, Madam Chair. I think Director Jester did a good job of introducing us to the issue that Senator Winters brought up. But has that been looked at in judiciary committees? Because there's been some press coverage that questioned whether that board should be internal or should be outside people. I think Mr. OIA director has appointed a committee from within. And are we going to play any role or provide any direction on that, or is that being done by judiciary?
Representative Wisnan, it's my understanding from after talking with the Senate Judiciary, Senator Burdick, that the committee does not intend to hold hearings on the matter. They've reviewed the record of the hearing in this committee, and then I'm going to ask Mr. Jester, when we get to his agency presentation, to bring us up to date on what is planned going forward around ongoing investigations, the outside external review, et cetera.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The other comment I would make about the Multnomah County gang funding is that the operating is that the funds were to be distributed equitably within the county. And I would ask Mr. Jester, again, when we come to your presentation, if you would just recap for the committee what that distribution looked like. Again, what the expectations are around outcomes and any other comments you would make for the record about the distribution of the Multnomah County gang. Would that be helpful to you, Representative?
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Another question related to the audit, Ms. Baker, the Secretary of State's audit. It's my understanding that the audit is limited to it's more of a financial audit than it is a program audit or looking at the program side of the agency.
Madam Chair, yes, the change of director review that is done is very limited in scope. It does not look at all the operations of the agency or all the programs of the agency. It's just saying now that the director has changed over, has the agency done what it needed to do relative to that change? And was there anything in terms of an overview, was there anything that stood out as areas that we needed to investigate upon this change of director?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Moving on then, and thank you, Ms. Baker. Ms. Gilbert, would you like to provide the governor's budget overview, please?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Lynn Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services. And we'll be working from the display that starts with this page. On the second page, or on page two of this handout, we have the context display that we will see many times more before we're all done with our work here. Of the of all funds in the governor's budget, $2.4 billion are public safety program area funds, and of that amount, the Oregon Youth Authority has budget is $246.9 million, or about 10% of the public safety total funds. Of general fund and lottery, the Oregon Youth Authority has $208.2 million, or about 13.3% of all of the $1.6 billion that's spent for public safety, general fund, and lottery. Next page, page 3, simply states that in the governor's principal's budget, this agency's entire budget falls within the principle related to public safety, which is that Oregonians are safe in their homes, communities, and in state institutions. The next four pages will be four different views looking at the same budget from four different directions by fund type, by program, by budget category, and then finally with a historical view. On page four, this is the view by fund type, and certainly the lion's share, 85% of this budget is general fund at around $208 million, followed by 10% federal funds at $25.66 million, and finally 5% of the budget is other funds at $13 million. There are notes about revenues. Ms. Baker discussed those in her overview, so I think we can go on. Page 5 shows the agency's budget by program unit. I will start with the largest one in the southeast corner, I think, and that is facilities. Facilities budget is 48% of the total budget at $118.3 million. And then the next largest portion is the community programs portion, just under $100 million, or about 40% of the total budget. In addition, we have administration coming in at about 9% of the total budget at $21.8 million. Debt service, $6.6 million, is 3%. And finally, there's $630,000 for capital improvements. The next page shows the view by budget category, or on what things will the money be spent. And the largest portion is the personal services. It's $132.9 million, or about 54% of the budget. And for reference, of that amount, about $126 million is general fund, so 95% of that amount is general fund. And this is very typical of agencies that operate 24-hour institutions. They will be heavy in personal services. Moving to the left on the bottom of the pie, there's services and supplies at about $34 million, or just under 14% of the total budget. And capital outlay, as we said before, is about just under $500,000, around 0.2% of the budget. Special payments come in at about $73 million, or just under 30% of the budget. And finally, we have a debt service at $6.6 million, 2.7% of the budget. That's that.
Representative Hannah?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Gilbert, where within those categories is inmate health care? Under which of those?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, that would be in facilities.
Do you know what that number is, just for health care for inmates?
I could look it up, didn't you do?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, it's actually part of our answers to questions that were posed on March the 17th, and the cost for direct patient care is $6,879,000. Medications and supplies is $2.2 million. Inpatient hospital is $54,000, and community services is $40,000. And I do want to clarify that on the inpatient hospital, those are offenders who are in the community or are placed from our facility and then into a community hospital, and so we are using Oregon Health Plan for those payments. That's why that number is low. And the direct patient care would cover everything from nursing care services to physicians, dentists, psychiatry, psychology. Those will all be included in that $6.8 million cost.
Madam Chair, just a follow-up, and this might not be the appropriate time, but at some point, I think it's going to be worth our time as a committee and as the legislature looks at these things within OYA and Department of Corrections to look at a healthcare model that might resemble managed care, if you will. In other words, some kind of a model for healthcare where we can really work closely on these healthcare costs within these facilities. Because, again, and I've said this before, but and I know we have an obligation to serve these people, but it's terribly difficult to go home and talk to people that have jobs and are working and, you know, paying taxes, but yet they can't afford the health care. And you hear it constantly when you're in district about, you know, I ought to be in jail, I'd get better health care. And I'm not arguing that they should get less health care, but I am saying we need to be fiscally very responsible with the dollars we're spending within those facilities, and to see that we're getting the absolute best, most efficient delivery system we can.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mrs. Gilbert, this morning in education, we looked at what the rate of PERS was. What rate is this 53.8%? What PERS rate? Was that based upon what?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnot, the rate that was used to develop the budget was 15.52% of salary.
15.52. Madam Chair?
Yes.
I think from our meeting this morning, you know, we were told that it's actually going to be 14.8, wasn't it? From our education committee?
Madam Chair.
Certainly.
There are different rates for state employees versus school employees.
Okay.
School employees, not school districts, are all pooled under a school employee classification, and their rates might be approximately, they'd actually be a little bit higher than that. But the problem now in trying to compare rates, to be honest, in PERS, is different agents, well, the state has this, but different local entities also have PERS obligation bonds. And so that actually effectively reduces their rates, but you have to look both at their rate and what they're paying on the bonds to determine what the true rate is.
Madam Chair, if I may. Madam Chair, Representative Wisnant, the rate that will be used in the legislatively adopted budget will be lower than the 15.52%. This was the rate we used for the governor's budget.
Yeah.
But through adjustment, I believe, Ms. Baker, to all budgets, that rate will be reduced for the budget that you put out.
Right. If I might follow up.
Certainly.
We did find that for state employees, when those figures were released, we estimated that there was about a $10 million reduction in cost of PERS from where we thought the increase would be. And that was included in some of the budget discussions that they've had in terms of analysis of the entire budget, because it came in a hair below where we thought it would be. That literally is a $10 million is a hair in that calculation.
Madam Chair.
So
it sounds like statewide, there will be more than even the $10 million savings that we...
No, Madam Chair. State school fund, or school districts, the number came higher than anticipated. So it's kind of a washout.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please continue. I am moving now to page 7 of the display, and this gives some of the history of the agency's budget over time from 1999-01 through the governor's recommended budget in 2005-07. You will note that there are changes in the final column from the 2003-05 legislatively approved budget. General fund is up 5.8%. Other funds up a little, federal funds down a little, for a total increase of about 4.8%. Some of the components of that, some of the increase components are simply ordinary inflation on personal services and supplies. In addition, there was some extraordinary inflation on medical costs within services and supplies. There's also some resource allocated to relocate one of the parole and probation offices. Offsets where there were reductions in costs were savings for the Oregon Project Smart Buy, and as noted earlier, the reduction to gang services funding, about $600,000 reduction. And finally, there's a reduction in debt service around $2.6 million that accounts for two things. One is paying off debt or COPs borrowed for the juvenile justice information system, and the other reflects releasing the property at Ochoco. The Ochoco property has been transferred to military, and the Department of Administrative Services has taken on the debt service for that and in turn charges military for the same amount to recoup that debt service. That amount of debt service is reduced from the Oregon Youth Authority budget.
And what was the change in federal funding?
M- Madam Chair, do you mean why or what was reduced or taken away? Or?
Yes, that's the question.
Off the top of my head, I'm going to say that at least part of that was due to match rate change. And there may have been a grant. For the record, I'm Karen Olsen, the Assistant Director for Business Services for the Oregon Youth Authority. The decrease in federal funding is due to having less eligible services in a particular program we have called Targeted Case Management. That is where we connect youth in the community, give them access to health services, but the same people who do that also provide transition programming for youth who are in close custody. And as we have found, transition programming is a very evidence-based type of program. We have been moving more towards providing more transition services to individuals within close custody, but they are not eligible for Medicaid, and therefore we cannot get targeted case management on those. So we're still doing the program, but there's less eligible services.
Thank you very much. Please continue.
Thank you. On page 8, we begin a discussion of the policy issues and assumptions in the governor's budget. And as you have heard before, it pretty much maintains the same level of services as are available in the 2003-05 budget. In other words, 850 close custody beds, resources to provide for 670 residential or foster care placements, community services contains 182 positions for parole and probation counseling and services. On page 9, we discuss cost drivers that lead to this particular budget. The first thing, of course, would be arrest rates among juveniles. The next three drivers are address beds that must be made available by law, and this would be the Measure 11 offenders who are under age 18 on the date of their crime. Waived offenders who are the juveniles who commit other serious crimes that allow waiver to the adult judicial system. And finally, the public safety reserve youth, and these are youth age 15 or younger who have committed certain serious felonies. Another cost driver is the population of special needs youth, and this is discussing mental health needs and substance challenges, things of that nature, extra care required. And finally, another cost driver is the federal matching rate, as has just been discussed. Moving to the final page, under
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Measure 11 offenders, what percentage of the close custody beds are held by Measure 11 offenders?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, that is such a good question, and I thought of it about 10 minutes before coming over here and giving it a specific number, but we can certainly get that for you.
Great. Thank you.
And there we are. We have it. Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, the Measure 11 youth, that is March 3rd, 154 of the 850.
Less than 1650, what do you think?
18%.
No.
How many did you say?
154.
Yeah. 18%.
Follow up, please, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
Well, that number, and I'm not sure that I understand this, but will that number grow? Will Measure 11 offenders, as you're looking at the numbers we saw in terms of the prediction for your population that's coming at you, will the Measure 11 offender number grow?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I think Sue Porter is going to be able to discuss that when she talks about developing the forecast. I think it has a different impact on the adult population from the youth population because the youth age out of these beds, and the adult population doesn't age out. They stay until they're finished. That makes sense.
Okay.
We will explore that with Ms. Porter when she comes up. It's an excellent question.
Okay. Thank you.
With respect to fee or revenue issues, as we discussed, we will probably at the work session be handling a fund shift to reflect new federal fund matching rates. Those became known and available about 3 days ago. So this is new information that will be applicable to the following, to the next biennium. And finally, with respect to technical adjustments, none that we know of so far.
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. We will move on then to the juvenile population demand forecast. And thank you, Suzanne Porter, for coming back.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Suzanne Porter with the Office of Economic Analysis, and with me today is Dave Beck. He's the Deputy State Economist, and we're here today to present our revised demand forecast and to explain to you what this notion of demand is, what it's based on. And I'll start with explaining demand. We've been doing semi-annual forecasts of the Youth Authority's population since 1998, and we look at the population in three groups: the adult court population, the public safety reserve, and then the discretionary bed allocation. Now, those first two groups, you could consider them arguably to be non-discretionary. In other words, they get the first crack at the beds that there are, and then whatever's left goes to the whatever's funded beyond that is the discretionary bed allocation. When we do a forecast of those first two groups, we are actually trying to forecast how many beds will be occupied by those people. Now, we used to try and do that with the discretionary bed allocation also, but because that is so dependent on funding level, what we were doing is just projecting the funding level forward. And then in 2003, when the facilities closed, it was just silly to continue to forecast that way. It was not giving anybody any valuable information. So we got together with an ad hoc committee, which the core of it was our regular advisory committee, which is on the last page of the forecast document. Those people help us do the forecast. And to that, we invited the budget analysts from Legislative Fiscal and Budget Management. We got a representative from the Juvenile Justice Information System, and then we invited any juvenile department directors that were interested in this exercise. What we did is, first of all, we got a data file, of which Jay just had to make for us. It was new. It's all juvenile referrals by the most serious allegation with their most restrictive disposition up to that point. And this is about between 200,000 and 300,000 records. And we, rather than talk about what demand should be, we agreed that it would be possible to look at the years 1996 through 2002. I'm going to look at kids that either went to the Youth Authority as discretionary bed allocation, that's all we're dealing with in this demand exercise, or kids that were last referred during that time. So that's what we call our study group. And we look at that time period because it represents a period of increase and decrease in the actual capacity. So we'll look at average behavior, not ideal behavior, what should be, but what was average practice before the facilities were so constrained by having the four facilities shut down. And the other thing we wanted to look at is, you know, not how people rated kids, but, you know, what is their actual track record, the observable characteristics. And this ad hoc committee was, before we even looked at the data, they said, you know, you'll find that these kids will be tend to enter the system younger. They'll have a lot of referrals. So you'll be looking at age of first referral, their current age, you know, the number of referrals they've had in the past, the seriousness of those referrals, and so on. So we had these data, and we used something called the binary choice model. And what this does is just it divides this study group of about 90,000 kids into two groups, people who went to the youth authority and people who did not. And we feed into it, you know, a bunch of characteristics. You know, what is their delinquency history? How many referrals have they had? You know, what were they for? What's their current age? What, you know, what was the age at the first referral and so on? Demographics also went in there. So the computer sorts through those and finds the characteristics that help define why this kid went and that kid didn't. And as part of that, it gives every kid a score between 0 and 1. And in our model, the higher the score, the more serious the offender, or, you know, as far as the more likely they were to have gone to the youth authority. So on page 2 of my testimony, there's a box. These are the things that were most, that the model found were most predictive of, you know, why a kid became part of the discretionary bed allocation. And number one was cumulative severity of all allegations. And the severity score is, it's in a computer system. It's not, you know, someone's opinion, but each crime has a severity score attached to it. And I think they go from 0 to 17 or 0 to 1 to 19 or 1 to 17, something like that. It's automatically attached to the crime. And our model was, we were able to predict accurately 80% of youth that went to the youth authority, 97% of the ones that didn't. Now, of all those 90,000 kids in the study group, about 3% of them actually went to the youth authority. And when we finally set a score to determine what demand is, the unmet demand ends up being another 1%. So it's not a huge number of kids. We're talking about the most serious 4% of all kids that are ever referred. And like, as I said, each kid has a score that the model automatically makes. It makes a an equation, and the equation, the answer will be between 0 and 1 for each kid. Now we have to decide, where are we going to set the bar? At what score does a kid have to become demand? If we make it too low, we're going to let a lot of kids into demand, and people might think we're, you know, advocating for more space. If we set it too high, we're going to miss too many kids that went. So our advisory committee is charged with determining demand, and how they do that is they've made two criteria for us to follow. One is that this mean score for all kids, the total demand population, those are kids that went to the youth authority and kids that are in the community but score high enough to be considered demand. Those two groups together are the total demand population. The overall mean score for that group has to be the same as for the kids that actually went. In other words, we can't water down the scores by letting a bunch of less serious offenders into the demand. And then the other criterion is that the age distribution for all these kids should be the same as the age distribution for kids that really went. So in other words, we can't have 10 times as many 12-year-olds that we say there's not a demand for 12-year-olds. So we have to make sure that it's not a lopsided population. For the most part, you know, as age goes up, the percentage of kids, few 12-year-olds, and as you get up to 17, it's a higher percentage. Ms. Porter, if you, Representative Hannah, did you have a question?
Yeah, I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to, if I can, go to layman's terms instead of your statistical data, just to try to get in my own head how this works. If your, quote, scorers group, which includes those who have a, who fall within the items in the box and measured out, and I think they would have a high score, not a low score, is
right,
that right?
Right.
Okay. So I want you to look at your what you wrote here, because it doesn't make sense to me, but I'm trying to think through it, because
okay.
I'm going to read what this says. These high-scoring youths who remain in the community are called scorers. Okay, we got that group.
Right.
The total demand population is composed of scorers, so those are people that are still in the community but scored high.
Right.
And the ones that are in close custody. Right.
Okay.
And next paragraph down, setting the critical score as a judgment call, a low score will allow many youths to become demand and give the appearance of advocating for more bed space.
Right.
Wouldn't it be a high score?
No, if we set that bar low.
If we set the bar low,
yeah.
It's not the score itself.
No. It's the critical score, that bar.
Okay. See my point there?
Yeah.
I mean, it makes it look like it was a high score once and a low score, but it's really a high score with a low bar.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it could be a little confusing.
I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, just follow up. So for those who stay in the community that are measured like those that are in the close custody, the matching points are their score, which makes them a score to mirror, and the age. Those are the two things that have to mirror up.
Right. Exactly.
Have you gone on to statistically speaking, now back to that, to for those that you have tracked as, quote, scorers, do they come into the system at the same rate that you scored them at? I mean, is there a relationship between those that you ranked as scorers compared to those who actually enter the system?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, and I'm not sure I understand.
Well, let me say it again. You pick this population. There's a bucket of people out there in the community. And you match a criteria to them. You give them a score. Those that are called scorers, they using the two criteria, you match them to the people that are in the facility. If you carried that forward, that model forward, would those that you identified as scorers in real life, did those that were identified as scorers, can you tell us what percentage of them actually end up in the system?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, we have not done that yet. We've done three of these forecasts, and that would be an interesting thing to look at.
Madam Chair, I don't know. I mean, statistics is a fun game. It really never tells you exactly what something is, but it always tells you exactly what it's not. And it seems to me, in order to make the data valid, you've really got to prove the equation. You've really got to prove that listing the group as a group that are scorers means down the road they, quote, scored. They ended up in the system. Otherwise, using them as a comparative data, it could or could not be the right data. It might be perfect. I'm not positive. But unless we track that, you see, we're leaving ourselves up to a, what may or may not be a great comparison.
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, there's no guarantee that they would wind up in the discretionary bed allocation, because that's a constrained population. So someone else might have gone in there ahead of them. I mean, there's not, that's the whole notion, is that there's not room for them. I mean, a couple years ago, there would be 600 kids in that population. Now there's 300, so somebody doesn't get to go. And just because they didn't get to go now is no guarantee that 6 months from now they do get to go, unless they're, you know, to commit another crime, maybe they would. It depends on who they're going to replace.
Madam
Madam Chair. I agree with that, and I understand that what we did is shrink the pool a little bit, and you're looking at a population outside of the pool and saying they're like them. My suggestion is just that it would give a lot of credibility to your data to know that you're mirroring a population, and if they finally do end up in there, you're going to say, you know what, I think we were using the right population to mirror to see that they ended up there. It just
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, that would be, I think in the off season, that would be an interesting thing to look at. For sure, we look at this person scored in the last data set, and they still continue to score, and then so that stays the same for the most part.
Madam Chair, may I add?
Certainly. If you would identify yourself.
Just reiterate what Sue mentioned.
If you would identify yourself for the record first, please. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, this is Dave Beck, Office of Economic Analysis. I just wanted to reiterate what Sue mentioned between your exchange. Because we are operating within constrained capacity, it would be very hard to know whether these scores will end up or will have to end up in the system. I mean, it's an open question. If OIA creates more capacity, then these scores may end up most likely in the RDBA. On the other hand, if the facilities continue to be constrained, then there is absolutely no guarantee that even these high scores could go to a DBA. So as much as we understand your concern, I think it's very hard to know whether these scores are really genuine demand or not within constrained capacity.
Did you wish to?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, it's a point of reference. I mean, we could create an equation in order to do so. If we had a 7% growth rate and a stagnant bed rate, and we knew how many scores there were, or we had a growing bed rate and a growing rate, we could still figure out how many people were coming or going. I mean, and you could still take a look at the population that you're mirroring against to decide, are we doing it right? It's just a method, in my mind, to validate that we're using good data to track, is all. And it's okay. We don't have to have that much conversation about it. I just like to know that we're tracking the right group. And I appreciate the effort and the work that you're doing towards it.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, and that's why we limit our analysis to their actual delinquency history, and you know, not how they've been rated by a caseworker. I mean, this is what their actual track record. So, assuming we set the score, we followed the criteria that our committee has given us, then we have to forecast demand. And that to do that, we use just standard method that we do for all our forecasting. It's called survival probability. It's used in demography. It's used in industrial engineering. You're just looking at what's the probability of becoming demand in each and every month after a kid is referred. And the probability of becoming demand is dependent on how young a kid starts being referred. So if you look at the chart on the last page of the testimony, there's two lines. The longer and higher line is for kids that are first referred at age 12 or younger. For those kids, they have the highest probability of ever becoming demand, or, if you will, going to the youth authority. And that takes several years for them to reach the peak demand. About by age 15, it grows till age 15. So these are kids. Some of them were referred before they turned 12, but they're really not at risk for going to the youth authority until they are 12. So these kids continue to be referred, and by the time they reach age 15, 16, or 17, they would be more likely to actually enter the youth authority. But they've been working on it for several years. By contrast, the smaller line there, those are kids that are first referred at age 16. They have a much lower probability of ever going to the youth authority, and the highest probability is, you know, when they're first referred. And it's probably because if they wait until they're 16 to ever be referred, it's going to tend to be a more serious allegation from the offset. So with that, there's a little more information on that in our forecast. Before I get to the numbers, if you would look at the box on page 3, the characteristics of this total demand population. Overall, about one-third of kids ever referred are first referred at age 13 or younger, just one-third. However, two-thirds of the total demand population are first referred at age 13 or younger. The average number of months that elapse between their first referral and when they either, you know, go to the youth authority or become demand, reach that score, is 39 months. And the average number of allegations or referrals that they've accrued by that time is 10 referrals. So you can, even though overall referrals might, you know, they have been going down, regardless of what happens to that, this is a small and distinct subset of kids that are ever referred and are not affected much by the big fluctuations in referral rate. Back on the first page, just an overview of our forecast. We estimate that the total demand for close custody beds was 1,048 as of January 1st of this year. Now, this includes the actual population in the youth authority and then, you know, the discretionary bed allocation kids, that the demand for DBA that isn't being met. And we estimate that that grew by 3.9% over the year. It was about 1,000 January 1, 2004. This current figure of 1,048 is 189 beds higher than the actual population on January 1st of this year, but it's 109 beds lower than the highest population ever, which was 1,157 on August 1st of 2000. If you look at the chart on page 2 at the top, you can see that our current forecast, which is a shaded area, is lower than the previous forecast, the line above it. That is due to a one-time revision in the source data. There was about 3,000 referrals that were removed, and that changed our scoring and took some of the people out that appeared to be demand before but are not now. Also, you can see that the population increases in the beginning, and then it's rather flat, and part of that is this demand recovering from what happened in 2003 when we not only had the facility shut down, but we also had the court system partially shut down, and just as the system recovers from that shock, the population grows, the demand grows, but then it's flat after that, and that has to do with that, again, that subset of kids that ends up being demand does not tend to grow with the overall number of people that are being considered grow or shrink. It's pretty stable. Page 5 is the adult court population in the table there. And that is the actual population that we're trying to forecast. That's Measure 11, and it's kids that are waived under OS 419C, whatever. So it's Measure 11 and kids that are waived. They're about equal numbers of those. On page 6 is a public safety reserve. Again, that's an actual population that we're trying to forecast. And then on page 7, table 12 at the top, that goes back to January of 2003 before the facility shut down, and it shows a historical population of the groups, including the discretionary debt allocation. And then over in the second to the last column is the demand for the discretionary debt allocation. And then the final column is the percentage of this DBA demand that was being met. So as January 2003, we show that 95% of the demand is being met. As the facilities close, that drops down. So since that time, on average, about 70% of demand for discretionary bed allocations is being met. And that's all I have. I hope I've explained. I tried to, the most important thing I guess I wanted to convey is that this demand is based on kids' actual track record and not, it is theoretical in a way, but at least we're not relying on how people rated them or what their opinion is of who should go and who shouldn't, as that is really depends on what part of the state you're in. But we looked at what kids actually did as far as their criminal history and what is their age and so on to arrive at that figure.
Ms. Porter, thank you very much for the preparation and for the information. For my part, I think it will take some additional review and reflection on the documents that you've provided. I know that some other questions will surface, but this has been very helpful. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, a lot. I didn't do very well in stats, but statistics, but... I think one thing that I would be concerned about or ask you to, if you looked at, is the economic situation. I mean, to me, if the parents are out of work and don't have the facilities or the financial resources to help the family, then that's going to increase our population too in the OYA. Do you look at economic situation and sort of any sort of forecast or prediction?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, that reminds me, you know, we don't have that kind of information on people, but the major improvement, hopefully, that we're going to be working on during the summer is that JGIS, they will be getting information from Department of Human Services as far as referrals for child protective services to look at abuse and neglect. So we hope to build a record that will show, you know, not only criminal referrals, but were the referrals for this kid as being abused or neglected, or someone in the family. And because this ad hoc group that advised us, they felt strongly that would be a factor in determining who is, you know, what kids become demand. So, you know, we won't exactly have economic information, but, you know, those two things are, you know, highly correlated. So we hope to be getting that sometime in the summer, and that it will help us improve our predictions.
Well, just to follow up, Madam Chair, I think that, you know, they say that, you know, more abuse, family abuse and child abuse occurs when there's an economic situation, a downturn. So that's a correlation there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And, Ms. Porter, I do think it's important that we get some comment on the record about the reliability of the forecast. You do have in this document a section toward the end on risk to the forecast. And again, we need to leave here with some understanding about reliability of the model and the forecast, which we have been using for some time now, but if you would.
Madam Chair, as far as the public safety reserve and the adult court populations, those are the groups who are trying to get at the actual populations. Those populations have been fairly stable, and our forecasts haven't been off by, I can't give you the percentages, but they haven't been off too much on those groups. Where we've run into problems in the past is when we were trying to forecast the number of DBA beds, which had not, you know, actually had to do with what was going to be funded, and we can't forecast that. So as far as the adult court population, that group has hovered around 300. The population of that group has been around 300 for several years now. At one point, it was up to about 325, and then it went down to 299, but that's the fluctuation that you'll get. With the public safety reserve, the fluctuation is even smaller. I mean, historically, you're going to go from about 180 to 200. It hovers in there. You don't get huge fluctuations in those groups. If you were to look at our forecast, when we were trying to forecast the actual population, the error that came into there was in the discretionary bed allocation. And that's just because the number of people in those beds depended on what got funded, and there's no way for us to take that into consideration.
But again, looking at the risk to the forecast, I'm just looking at the language that's here on page 7. You want us to understand that there's a risk that the public safety reserve population may grow beyond the forecast mm-hmm. in 2005, which would then have an impact on beds available for the discretionary beds
yes.
available.
Madam Chair, both those adult court and the public safety reserve, yes, there's a risk that they can grow beyond what we forecast, but the risk there, is the number of beds that they would be above what we forecast is not many. I mean, there's not much fluctuation in those groups. Historically, they've been pretty stable. With the discretionary or the public safety reserve, we had a bump up this year, last year. That was due to there was an increase in releases over the previous 2 years, and so the increase that we got was in kids being revoked from their parole. Other than that, yeah, there's risk, but the number of beds we're talking about is not great.
Ms. Baker, is there anything else that we should be aware of with regard to this presentation and the forecast?
Madam Chair, I'd just like to make a couple comments. One is relating to the discussion we just had here. The issue I think that the committee should consider is that if as the adult court and the public safety reserve populations grow and there's a limited capacity in the system overall, those offenders get beds. The impact programmatically is on the discretionary bed allocation and the beds that the counties would otherwise be able to access. So even though you have 850 beds overall, if you have a growing adult court and public safety reserve population, then it's the discretionary bed allocation and the county's access to those beds which is reduced. The other point I would make for the forecast overall, if you look at this report, you can see that it is down from the previous forecast. I would note that the governor's budget was based on the April 2004 forecast. That forecast was a little bit below, indeed, where this forecast was. So You have the governor's budget based on April 2004. When LFO did its analysis, I was looking at the October 2004 forecast. So between April and October, the forecast went up. Then it's come back down now because of the adjustment that Sue talked about. And so what you are actually looking at April to April is, in fact, a slight reduction even from the governor's budget. That really only becomes important as a comparison point, if you will, unless you're considering funding all of the total demand that is forecast, which doesn't seem to be in the cards. But I just did want to show, you know, the numbers change over time. Where we are with this forecast is just slightly below where the governor's budget forecast was.
Very good. Thank you very much, Ms. Porter and Mr. Beck. Thank you very much. Well, Mr. Jester, if you'd like to come back up, we'll hear from you. And I do want to start us off with the question and the concern raised by Representative Wisnot earlier. Frankly speaking, you know, part of our conversation here is about, you know, the dollars and cents of the budget, et cetera. But one of our greatest challenges is that we need to be able to ensure that, again, looking at the governor's principles, the governor's principle related to this budget says Oregonians are safe in their homes, communities, and in state institutions. And we need to be able to ensure that Oregonians are, in fact, safe in the institutions operated by the Oregon Youth Authority. So I would ask you to speak to us about where we are with ongoing investigations, what are the next steps around an external review of what all that has happened around the Boyles case, and we'll just speak to us, if you would, about where we are.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Bob Jester, Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. I have been joined by Deputy Director Phil Lemon, and the two of us have been working diligently on putting together an outside review committee and kind of outlining what we believe is important, some of the important questions that we would like to see answered, and then making certain that that committee has the full empowerment to go where, in fact, their work may lead them. We have had discussions with a number of people about being members of this committee, and we have looked at broad areas of law enforcement, courts, district attorney's office, and advocacy organizations. And we are currently completing a process to contract with Rod Brown, who is the retired police chief from the city of McMinnville and is currently a law enforcement management consultant. His most recent work, and hence the referral, has been the investigation and follow-up from the Eugene City Police Department of two police officials who I guess have now been convicted and have been sentenced for sexual activity with people on the job. And we are now just working out the particulars of his contract to come to the Youth Authority and put together this group and then be the facilitator of that process. So I'm going to ask Mr. Lemon to talk a bit more about some of those particulars. I'd be happy to answer any questions that folks have. We additionally have received some confirmations and tentative confirmations. I think Phil has probably the most updated information on who has agreed and who is tentative. Part of the problem that I think we're faced with, quite frankly, is that the more publicity there has been about this issue, we have some people that are less interested in participating, I think, on the review committee. So we're kind of working that end of it as well. So,
yeah, if we could clarify one thing. Did the governor delegate to you, Mr. Jester, and the agency the responsibility for figuring out how to go forward with an inquiry? The question that we're hearing is, why did the governor not name a group himself to conduct an inquiry? So again, the question is, did he delegate the role?
Madam Chair, when I have had conversations with the governor about this situation, I presented in that meeting the Oregon Youth Authority's plan to follow our past protocol and procedure when we have had a critical incident of putting together an outside review group to review that critical incident and make recommendations to the agency on how it could improve in the future. And we have two probably notable examples of experience in doing that, both tragically enough involved deaths in our close custody facility. And both of those happen to involve, coincidentally, the same kind of expert in this arena on institutional-related deaths. And that individual was contracted by the Youth Authority. We worked to put together a group representing then both advocacy, other parts of interested stakeholders. And those committees met, reviewed files, reviewed physical plants, spent time in our facilities, interviewed youth, interviewed staff, and reported out a set of recommendations. That set of recommendations was then shared not only with the staff that were involved, but also brought back to the legislature as a improvement plan. And in at least, in both those cases, it involved some requests for either funding and or shifting some existing funding. So when I met with the governor, I brought that forward to him. The governor did not ask me to put together a committee.
Okay. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Phil Lemon, Deputy Director of the Youth Authority. In response to Representative Wisnett's question earlier, Mr. Jester and I have met with many legislators in the building, committee chairs, leadership, individual legislators. As concerns come up, questions, whether they come to us, whether we hear about them and go to them, that's been an ongoing process. And so anytime we have heard of anyone's interest or concerns on this issue, we've gone and met with them. So in terms of legislative involvement, even though it may not show on the public record, there's been quite a bit. We are in the process, as Bob said, of getting final confirmations on participation. There are a couple people who need to check possible legal conflicts, whether they have dealt with any of these youth in the past, and then some just need to, I think, carefully about the level of commitment that they would be making to participate in this process, because we are asking them to conduct a thorough review and give us some very candid recommendations, and I think to their credit they are all taking that request very seriously and don't want to sign up for something that they feel that they have problems with fulfilling that commitment. The general charge would be to review the circumstances, and that we're leaving it as broad as the committee wants to define it, quite frankly. We do have some specific areas where we would like to get recommendations from them on, but we are not limiting their inquiry coming in. Generally, the charge will be to review the circumstances in this case, look at what the agency has done thus far in terms of policies, practices, procedures, organizational changes, and then, given that information, give us recommendations on what we should be either thinking about or doing to making sure that we're taking all appropriate steps to prevent something like this from happening again. But the charge to this group will be very open-ended to give them the rein that they feel that they need to come back and tell us and also tell you what the agency has done and should be doing to complete this. I would just add that as we've been discussing this with both the members of the committee and the legislators we met with, if they cannot complete their work within 60 days, then we would at least like them to come back with preliminary recommendations to the agency that we would share with this body before it adjourns. So you will have some ability to tell us and the committee whether you see gaps or holes or whether you think that the review has been satisfactory in your judgment. And also they will have the opportunity, if they wish, to come and talk to you directly. And so we are trying to set up a process that will answer the questions I think everyone has, whether it's from our standpoint as agency administrators, to you as legislators and our board of directors, and to the public in general. And as Bob alluded, this is set up on the process along the similar lines of the process that we have, that the agency has conducted in the past, where we've had youth deaths in facilities. There's been an external review panel come in. They've been given, I think, substantial access to anything they wanted to look at, people they want to talk to, records, documents, and have come back with specific recommendations for changes in policies, practices, and also even facility changes in the physical plant. And so I don't know that we have physical plant issues in this case, but we expect a very thorough review. As the other comment I would just make, Madam Chair, is that Rod Brown, who we're looking at as leading this effort, has been, in addition to being a retired police chief, is now a law enforcement consultant. He is asked to come into police agencies and investigate particular incidents, either where they don't have an internal review process or where they want an outside view of that process, but to look at specific incidents that have come up, but also to look at the systems that are or are not in place to monitor and review those things.
Representative Wisner.
Madam Chair, yes. I'm not going to try to attack OYA here, but I think as a citizen, as a parent, I'm disappointed that we don't have leadership from higher in this building. I don't know how OYA can contract with someone to look at their look internally in OYA to find the problems. And this problem doesn't just stop with OYA. It goes to Department of Human Services. I guess as a citizen and as a legislator, I'll probably ask my leadership that I don't think this is acceptable way to investigate this. It's not, and I'm not questioning OYA. I think this issue, because it's been in the press, it reflects upon the governor, it reflects upon us, and we need to set policy to be sure that doesn't happen in the future. And I don't think a contract by OYA to contract someone to say what we need to do and correct really is the solution.
I understand. Other comments? Mr. Jester?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I can understand and appreciate the concern that you have expressed. I would like to state on the record that if anyone on this committee or anyone in this body has recommendations, specific recommendations for a member to participate on that review committee, we would absolutely welcome that. It seems to me that sometimes, and I'm just having a conversation now, it seems to me that sometimes you're darned if you do and darned if you don't. If you are proactive and you take care of your own business, you're criticized for doing just that. And if you don't and you wait for someone outside to tell you you have to do it, you're then criticized for that. When I had a conversation with the governor about this issue, he asked me what OYA had done and what OYA was going to do. And at the conclusion of that conversation, he was satisfied that the steps that we had taken and the steps that we were going to take would get where we needed to go, which was to ensure that this kind of an incident would be less likely to occur in the future. And I would also like to add that when we put together the first outside review following the tragedies of the deaths in our facilities, that was also a contract. And Oregon has become somewhat of the national model for responding to those kinds of incidents and putting together a group of experts that can come in
and help guide the state and the agency in terms of things as policy and rule and staffing and culture and all the things been mentioned in this committee. So I don't apologize for leadership in the building. I think that there has been a concern and an acknowledgement by that leadership that the agency is moving ahead.
I think Representative Wisnot's point is that the concern I hear him raising is the concern that was expressed here back when we first heard the had you testifying in response to a series of questions from Senator Winters, and it's about ensuring the independence of the investigation. That's the crux of the issue. It's ensuring the independence of the investigation. From where I sit, I would say that I do have a great deal of confidence in the Juvenile Rights Project and their role on the committee or task force that's being formed. Confidence, a great deal of confidence in the Oregon Advocacy Center. But again, what we're trying to get at here is that the investigation needs to be independent. That's what I'm hearing from Representative Wisnot. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jester, have you, excuse me, had any conversations with DHS in terms of how their component, the foster care certification, how that part of the investigation is going, or the bounds of your investigation, whether it's going to cover both areas of activity, or how have you dealt with that?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, we've had an ongoing conversation with DHS. We have sent them the documents that, you know, we have gathered. We have sent them copies to the questions that Senator Winters posed and the answers that we provided to this committee. I have had several conversations and meetings with the leadership of DHS in general about foster care and in general about certification and specifically about this case. We would not see the committee being bound to the information from only Oregon Youth Authority files, but also the information that would still be potentially contained at DHS. Recognizing that when the foster home came over, when we split the welfare and the juvenile corrections functions into two different agencies and then two different departments, the file on the foster home and the file on the worker both came over. So those records we do have, and those were some of the records that were reflected in the answers to Senator Winter's questions. I don't believe that my conversations with DHS would indicate any concern about individuals looking into how these decisions going back as many as 12 years ago might have been made. We all see this as a necessary and important learning process, and I think they share that same position.
So will the committee that you are putting together have this specific charge to look at the DHS role in the matter?
Madam Chair, we have not discussed specifically with the committee the charge of looking at DHS. We have discussed with the committee the charge of looking at the foster home certification process, and the current organizational and managerial and supervisory structure of the Youth Authority and our rules, policies, etc. DHS foster care system now is separate from our foster care system.
Does that answer your question, Representative Hansen? Are you satisfied with that response? Okay. All right. Well, I believe we can move on to the rest of your formal presentation, if you will.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for purposes of my presentation, I am starting on page 26. Which is titled The Governor's Recommended Budget. And that page is reflected by the
foam board up on the easel. As just a background in trying to create some continuity between phase one and phase two, and we feel fortunate there hasn't been much time between them, I would like to remind folks of my opening comment. This is page 26 of the agency overview. My opening beginning comments with the phase one, which was a quote from the Governor's Task Force on Juvenile Justice from 1995. And that quote is, right now, there are no consequences for unlawful actions. There is no certainty of punishment. There is no accountability. The result, an escalation of offenses until the conduct is so outrageous that the system is forced to respond. And that's where the Oregon Youth Authority started in 1995 with its charter as a department within the public safety area of state government. And from its inception, the Oregon Youth Authority has never been fully funded for the continuum that was envisioned by that task force, which met over a period of 1 year, making the recommendations, which then became Senate Bill 1, which then resulted in the creation of the Youth Authority. So as a starting point, I think to keep in mind some of our conversations from phase one and some of the pieces of the continuum that have never been there. The governor's recommended budget, as was presented by both Ms. Baker and Ms. Gilbert, is a total of $247 million of total funds, of which the vast majority of that, 85%, are general fund. If you look at the breakout of where those funds are spent, you'll see that 48% are for our facility services, close custody. We have 40% that are going to our community program services, less than 1% for capital improvement, 3% for debt service, 3% for agency-wide, and 6% for administration, totaling the 100% in the top pie chart you see. In the governor's recommended budget, the revenue source, 85% as mentioned, is general fund. 5% are other funds, and those are almost exclusively coming in from child support, trust, and Social Security payments to the agency. And 10% is from federal funds, and primarily that's from Medicaid match and administrative costs for Medicaid, along with approximately $2.2 million in federal school lunch collection that the agency is able to receive in the institutions. On page 27, factors that drive OIA costs. I think the most important factor that drives the cost is a local court commitment and sentencing practices. And I say that from this list because it is, in fact, a result of the local continuum of services and sanctions and capacity that is available at the local level that greatly dictates the outcome of sentencing and commitment practices by the court. There are young people that are escalating in their behaviors that may have risk factors, mental health, alcohol and drug, victims of sex abuse, the social characteristics that we spoke about in phase one. But there are services locally and there are programs locally that those youth are able to benefit from. And based on the benefit from those programs, the court is not placed in a position of either or, either commit them to a youth correction facility or not have them receive service. But they can continue in the community, have local supervision, and access programs that are available in those communities. And that is the piece that I hope, if nothing else, we were able to talk with this committee about in terms of the continuum of service and sanctions in juvenile justice. I believe it's a crux of the
formation of Oregon Youth Authority and really the result of the work of Senate Bill 1 is speaking to that continuum. And the Oregon Youth Authority, as you recall, deals with 0.5 or half a percent of the at-risk population in the state. 4.5% is dealt with by local juvenile departments in their local communities. And again, the good news reiterating is that 95% do not have contact with the juvenile justice system. So I believe that that is the most important driver, is what is available at the local level that influences the behavior on the part of the courts and sentencing practices. We've heard from Ms. Gilbert this morning about the special needs of youth, absolutely, and then there are ballot measures and legislative policy decisions that also drive what services we are funded to provide or what services we have to provide. Cost containment and improvement of the program, on page 27 again, OIA aggressively utilizes video and teleconferencing to deliver training as an alternative to travel. We spoke a bit about our use of that same technology for delivering some of our psychiatric oversight for our distance facilities where there is not that level of professional either available or interested in doing a contract for services. We continue to collaborate with the Department of Human Resources, services, to maximize cost efficiencies for health-related services. And we have negotiated with providers to accept the Oregon Medicaid reimbursement rate for community services provided to OIA within OIA facilities. And we have leveraged agency general fund to match federal funds in purchasing capacity in juvenile psychiatric residential centers for OIA youth.
Mr. Jester, let me go back to the video conferencing as a viable way to provide psychiatric services. What kind of outcomes with that approach? With the traditional approach, there's a live body opportunity to have a relationship. How do you do that with video conferencing?
Madam Chair, that's an excellent question because it assumes, I think, rightfully on the Chair's part, that our facilities are funded at a level that the psychiatrists have a therapeutic relationship with the youth offenders that they're contracted to serve. In fact, the psychiatric services are primarily limited to an intake assessment and then medication monitoring. And when a youth is going to be in a facility where they're going to have that relationship via teleconferencing with a psychiatrist, two things occur. The initial assessment of that youth is done face-to-face with that provider at McLaren as part of the intake. Medication, if that's what is necessary, is going to be prescribed and is going to be stabilized before the youth offender is transferred to a facility where the follow-up check-ins with the youth would be done via teleconferencing. Once every 3 months, that psychiatrist visits that facility and has a face-to-face with that youth. In the interim, we use our nursing staff to check for any kind of adverse effects from the medication, and we also have the regular general practitioner doctor that would be available for any other routine medical. So it is primarily an opportunity to do a check-in with the youth on medication monitoring, not to establish a therapeutic long-distance relationship. Those youth, if that was required, would be retained in a facility where we had a psychiatrist that was there on a regular basis.
That additional detail is very helpful, but I also remain troubled by the lack of services available to many of our rural communities, and not just in this arena. It's a continuing problem, systemic problem we have here in Oregon. But please continue.
Madam Chair, you're absolutely right, and it is, in fact, in the rural areas of the state that the service is being used. OIA in 1999 began purchasing food from the Department of Corrections, and this is another efficiency that we have now built on. All of our youth correctional facilities are now receiving food from the Department of Corrections. The Juvenile Justice Information System, we spoke a great deal about this during Phase 1, but it is another area that we believe represents an efficiency of 37 entities that are using a common information system that is seamless from the point of first referral through county, potentially through state, and potentially back to county, that information is available. Turning to page 28, as you will see, there is a chart that shows the general fund, as Ms. Gilbert spoke of, from the 2001-03 legislatively adopted budget, and then the 2003-05 legislatively adopted budget, and the bottom looking at the 2005-07 governor's recommended budget. And although there is growth, that growth reflected in the 2005-07 budget, it still falls 9% short of the 2001-03 budget. OIA requested funding of $251 million in general fund from the governor to continue our current programs and improve services. The cost to continue current services, or as was called this session, the essential budget level, is estimated to be $237 million general fund. This includes merit increases for employees not at top step of salary range, continuing health care benefits at close to current levels, cost of living increases for supplies, services, and our community providers, and the mandated caseload based on close custody demand forecast, which you heard the presentation from Ms. Porter, which would have increased by 285 beds our close custody capacity, and would have had a corresponding increase in foster care and associated increase in parole and probation, along with the administrative support for those particular increases. That was not funded in the governor's recommended budget. In order to balance to available revenues, the governor has recommended funding for OIA's essential budget level. The reduction has been slightly over 12%, equaling $29 million from general fund. And funding was eliminated for the following. All increases due to mandated caseloads, including the 285 beds in close custody demand forecast and foster care growth. A 22% decrease in state funding for Multnomah County gang services, and the expected cost savings to Oregon's Smart Buy program. And those were actually a savings to the state that were obviously moved out of the OI budget.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jester, when you say continuing health care benefits at close to current level for your essential budget level, are you also saying that with the governor's recommended budget, your health care benefits will, for current employees, be reduced?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I don't believe that's what I'm saying. I could be more affirmative and say that's not what I'm saying.
Can I follow up then, please, Madam Chair? So maybe you could expand on continuing health care benefits at close to current levels under the essential budget level, what that actually would mean.
I know when I'm in trouble when the question has to be asked twice.
Well, it's okay.
For the record, again, I'm Karen Olson, the Assistant Director of Business Services with the Oregon Youth Authority. When we're building a budget, the Department of Administrative Services sets certain guideline figures for us, and they set a figure that I believe approximates the amount of health benefits that employees are currently getting. I think it's close, but not quite equal to that. So that's what that statement represents, that at least at this point in the governor's recommended budget, there would be enough funding for close to the amount of health care benefits people are getting.
I'd like to follow up one more time, Madam Chair. I'm just not aware of any decrease in public employee health care benefit at this point on any of the budgets we're looking at. So I want to understand that. I'm not aware of any decrease in the public employee health benefit plan.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, if I may, this may help, this may make it worse, but let me give it a shot in my helpful notes here. The governor's recommended budget funds a flexible benefit contribution of $771 per employee per month, generally. In this case, yes, for OIA. Any additional contribution that might be bargained that would be different would be funded later from what in the governor's recommended budget is what we call the salary pot, a bucket of dollars put aside on a contingent basis for outcomes from bargaining. That made it worse, I can tell.
Ms. Baker.
Madam Chair, let me take a stab at it. I think the answer is nobody knows for sure until the bargaining is done exactly what the costs are going to be. There is an estimate that's built into the governor's budget, but the agency can't say for sure now whether that will be enough. So there isn't a cut, per se, taken specifically in the governor's budget on that line item. But it may not be adequate depending on what the outcome of the bargaining is.
I think it's fair to for all of those explanations to work. And again, what I want to say here is, and we all have this responsibility, but I know in my office, in this building, when people come to see me and they ask that question and they say, and they come in and say, no, we're not getting equal health benefits, I don't want to look at your data and say, you know what, it's a possibility you're not going to get that if that's not the case. If it is, I'm okay with saying it, but if it's not, or it's awfully questionable, it's hard to have a good conversation with the advocates that are coming in to answer the question. And so I like to vet that out and know. If we're going to reduce benefits, let's say we are, or if we just say there's a possibility that there's still a final benefit level to be determined, let's do that. But let's not say we're going to reduce them if we're not. And let's, again, just to have that transparency, let's be as clear as we can with what we're saying.
Very good. Did you wish to respond? Okay. Please continue. And we have about 4 minutes remaining, Mr. Jester.
I'm going to move really quick. At the bottom of the page, you will see the packages included in the governor's recommended budget. This package includes the abolishment of existing positions to fund 6 FTE of qualified mental health professionals, which would bring McLaren up to the recommended standards by the outside independent review that was done following a death at McLaren. They did not have the same level of qualified mental health professionals that we have in our other facilities, nor do they meet the national standard. And the governor approved in his recommendation the abolishment of existing positions to fund those. The governor's recommended budget, now I'm on the top of page 29, eliminated, again, the close custody beds and community programs associated with the demand forecast. Reduced Multnomah County gang, continues facility services and community program services associated with the restoration in 0305. You recall, please, that represents a 25-bed capacity in Eastern Oregon facility located in Burns, and the 25-bed capacity
locating the facility in Warrenton, and that represents a roll-up cost for 24 months funding for both those 25-bed units. Abolishes existing positions to fund the 6 qualified mental health professionals at McLaren, and funding and approval to relocate the OIA Clackamas Parole and Probation Office, and the reduction of the Money Safe and the Smart Buy program in telecommunications office supplies and office equipment. If you look at the policy option packages, we would request the ability to go through the essential packages as part of the individual presentations with facility and community to put those into some programmatic context for you. But the policy packages on the bottom of 29, 090, the Smart Buy, and Multnomah County gang reductions, that's $664,000 in general fund. 140, the mental health services and safety enhancements, that's $3,900, but with the addition of one FTE. And the Clackamas Parole and Probation Office relocation is $25,000 one-time cost in general fund to do that relocation. Ms. Gilbert went over the chart at the bottom of 29, and on page 30, our sole piece of agency legislation, House Bill 2051, which in a very timely manner clarifies that the Oregon Youth Authority will certify youth offender foster homes to serve youth offenders committed to legal custody of OIA. That status on that bill, it's currently passed the House and is pending in Senate Judiciary.
Madam Chair, real fast.
Yes.
Do you, Mr. Jester, do you get FBI background checks on all your foster home people?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, yes, we do a national fingerprint-based check on foster parents as well as staff and volunteers.
Well, this seems like a good place to conclude for today. Did you have an additional?
Madam Chair, with the permission of the committee, I would like to hand out our written responses to the questions from phase one and give the committee members an opportunity to look at those, and we would be happy to answer those questions if there are any follow-ups on that on Wednesday.
Let's look forward to doing that. Any concluding comments or questions, Representative Hanna?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be quick, and maybe this could get answered in our next meeting. But in terms of the six FTE that we're abolishing the positions for the six qualified mental health folks, do we have six funded yet unfilled positions that we will fill with that, or are we going to cut people loose?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, those represent two principal executive manager B positions, which we have abolished, and one principal executive manager A position. So three of those are managers that we will do without. One is a unit coordinator, which is like an assistant manager, but is represented. And one was a half-time rehab therapist or recreational therapist that was located in one of our facilities.
Okay. If there's no further business, then we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.